The following Bible study is presented by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
So thank you to those people who are able to join us for the Bible study this evening. Let's go ahead and open up to Genesis 4 to begin the study. My Bible's already open, but before I begin the meat of the Bible study, I would like to mention a few things that I think are worth noting, something that maybe I perhaps should have mentioned in some of the previous Bible studies when we went through the burnt offering and the grain offering and also the peace offering. There are some who believe that the offerings, also considered to be sacrifices in many cases when animals are involved, that these were approved by God shortly after the exodus of Israel out of Egypt. And so they consider these offerings, these sacrifices, to be part of the statutes. Maybe I shouldn't set this here because this table does move. Part of the statutes, they consider them to be part of those statutes that God gave to Israel, and then therefore they only applied for a limited period of time. Some even think that the animal sacrifices are associated with religious rites of pagans, and that they were given long before the people of God had given any such offerings to him, and for this reason, because the people of Israel were familiar with them, that God had decided to include them in some of the religious rites of his people. But that is not the case at all, and I want to make it clear to us that it's not the case. Even though idolaters had long worshipped false gods, and they may have given sacrifices and offerings in fire, it was not something that originated in paganism. Consider some of the history of the offerings of this sort found in the Bible. In Genesis 4 and verse 1, this talks about the birth of Cain and Abel. And it says in verse 3 that in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Eternal, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Eternal respected Abel and his offering, but he didn't respect Cain and his offering. Cain was angry, and we know the story. But my point is that this offering was brought to God in the process of time. Now, some of you that have Bibles with marginal notes, as I do, it says that this literally means at the end of days. And so the offering that was given by these two individuals points to enumerating days to a required offering. And when we think about what God declared later, we understand that this points to an observance of the Feast of Weeks. This would have been counting a number of days or weeks, 49 days, 7 weeks plus one would be 50. And at the end of the time, there was a required offering to be brought to God. And so the offering of grain by these individuals or of animals, how would they offer those things to God at that time? Well, the only way to present them to God would have been likely to burn them in fire. And so, Genesis 8, if you just go maybe a page or two forward, that's one example. And offerings of this nature are documented again later after the great flood. And God called Noah, one of the few righteous individuals in the earth at that time. He required him to construct an ark. And Noah and his family went into the ark with pairs of clean and unclean animals. And after Noah and his family spent 290 days in the ark, they came out of the ark. And look what it says here in chapter 8 of Genesis in verse 18. It says, Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with them. And every animal and every creeping thing and every bird and whatever creeps on the earth according to their families went out of the ark. And then it says Noah built an altar to the Eternal and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So we understand there were seven pairs of the clean animals, and so Noah would be able to, there would be extra for them to have been used while they were on the ark, and then to offer an offering, burnt offering, it calls it, on the altar that Noah had assembled. And it even says in verse 21, and the Eternal smelled a soothing aroma. And the Eternal said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Something that's kind of inherent in our human nature here. But in any case, the point is that this is another indication of a free will offering that was given to God, and it even calls it a burnt offering. So this included animal sacrifices. Blood would have been shed by Noah, and the flesh burned on the altar. And this is in the same category of the offerings that we had discussed already, the burnt offerings, and also a similar way the offering is presented. Not exactly, it's different in the sin offering, which we'll discuss this evening, but we're going to talk about that. Genesis 22, for another example here, Genesis 22, there's another account of this type of offering, and it was during the time of Abraham, and this was after the son of promise, Isaac, was born. And even though there's a large span of time between Noah and Abraham, I don't think that indicates that offerings of this sort were not given at all by people who revered God. It just, there's no documentation of it. But we do have this documentation here in verses 1 through 3. When it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. And he said, Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I shall tell you. And so Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took of his young men with him, and Isaac his son. He split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. So this was not an easy thing for Abraham to do. I'm sure that he was quite saddened and very stressed about what God was asking him to do. But he wasn't entirely confused about it, because what's, I think, is worth noting in this is that Abraham understood that offerings of this sort, not a human, but of this sort, burnt offerings, were given to God. And so Abraham didn't question, what's this strange thing all about? It indicates he was aware of these things. And even later in the same chapter, when Isaac asked him in verse 7, Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, My father, and he said, Here I am, my son. And he said, Look, the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for a burnt offering? So Isaac knew what this was for. It wasn't unfamiliar to him. And of course, Abraham replied, My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. And the two of them went together. And so let's go all the way forward to the book of Job now. Esther, Job, and then Psalms. I know we don't go there that often, but it is a fascinating and a very important book, the book of Job. It's in fact believed by some that Job is a descendant of Abraham. And it's possible, I suppose, that he was a descendant of Esau. There is a king or two in the scriptures that is called Jobab. Some think that this was a reference to Job, and that some think that, though, that Job, actually, the book of Job dates back to a time before Abraham. But in any case, Job was a God-fearing individual. He was an individual that had great concern for his family and for those people that he cared about. He was a wealthy individual. The book says that he had 7,000 sheep, he had 3,000 camels and 500 donkeys and 500 oxen and a large household. And certainly, of course, that would be the property of a wealthy individual, a landowner, if not the leader of a large community of people. And so Job's sons were accustomed to having parties called feasts in this first chapter. And apparently Job was concerned about the behavior of his sons during these feasts. And so in verse 5 of Job chapter 1, So it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God, which is an expression basically meaning to turn away from God, curse God in their hearts. And it says that Job did this regularly. Now, some people believe that the offense, or possible offense, was because Job's sons were celebrating birthdays. Now, while the feasts may have taken place on the days marking his son's birth, it appears that Job's concern was not necessarily for the reason for having a festive event itself, but rather if they had possibly sinned during this festive event, possibly, you know, drunkenness, maybe lewd behavior, or done something that turned away from the kind of behavior that God expected of people. And the reason I point it out is because if recognizing a birthday was in fact a sin, Job wouldn't have questioned whether it was a sin or not. He would have said, this is a sin, I want to make a burnt offering to try to make up for it. But he didn't know. But the point of this is to understand that Job was making burnt offerings here. And we know what those burnt offerings consisted of. We had already done, that was the first study that we went through. And even though that study talked about the offerings that would be presented at the temple, it is a similar type of offering. Now, later in the book of Job, if you go forward several pages to chapter 42, God rebukes Job's two friends for not saying what was right about God, and he instructed these two men in chapter 42 and verse 8. He said, now therefore take for yourselves seven bulls and seven rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. And so here's another example. Clearly this was something that they were familiar with, making a burnt offering to God. God even commanded that they go and make this offering on their own behalf. And so we see that even falls into this category of a sin offering, perhaps trespass offering, which the study is going to be broken into two parts. We're going to talk about the sin offering this evening. And Exodus 18, if you go back now, Job would have been before the book of Exodus, but we'll go back to Exodus 18. The last example I want to give here of a sacrifice in order to honor God was after Moses had led Israel out of the land of Egypt. And shortly before arriving at Mount Sinai, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, a man called the priest of Midian, a man who knew about God, knew about the true God, a man who was a descendant, in fact, of Abraham, born through his wife Keturah. Jethro wasn't born from Keturah directly, but a descendant of that woman. Jethro came to Moses to see what God had done. And after seeing the multitudes of people, after hearing about the miracles that God had performed on behalf of Israel, look what Jethro did. And it was in great joy. Jethro said, blessed be the Eternal, in verse 10, blessed be the Eternal who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Eternal is greater than all the gods, for in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them. And then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses, his father-in-law, before God. And so it was that Jethro presented this offering on behalf of God. It was in honor of God, and Moses didn't question this. Moses didn't say, like, what is this strange thing you are doing, Jethro, by offering animal sacrifices in honor of God? This was known. It was deemed acceptable and even honorable, the right thing to do at this time. And we see that God, there's no indication that God was offended by this. It's like, what are you doing? This is something that the pagans do. No, this is something that God was very familiar with and even required it at times. And so with this in mind, I want to just make that point clear so that some people don't go back and question whether these things should have been instituted or not. They definitely should have. God does not do anything without purpose, and God does not, he tells us not to learn the way of the heathen. He certainly isn't going to learn the way of the heathen himself and say, yeah, do what the heathen are doing. And so let's go ahead to Jeremiah 7 now. Jeremiah chapter 7. To begin the actual study of the sin offering. There is something becoming more and more common throughout our society, throughout the world today. It's become the norm today. It's become a preferred way of life by many people. It is behaviors and activities that evolve around this terrible thing called sin. And we see that sin is glorified today. It's glorified in movies and in video games. We saw some of that in the telecast that was presented yesterday during the Sabbath service. We see sin that is portrayed in memes and even in cartoons. Sin is memorialized on the airwaves, found in the music that people listen to. And it seems that most people no longer view sin as something that is abhorred and something that we should try to avoid. Instead, the majority of people, they open their arms to sin. They relish in sin. They enjoy the activity. And it seems like a minority of people seem to recognize the consequences that sin will have both in this life and also in the next. Even most people who say they are Christian, and even people that may practice Judaism, they rarely talk about the cost of sin anymore. People go about their lives today just doing whatever it is that pleases them, not realizing what the end result of sin will be if they don't repent, if they don't turn their lives around and do what is right according to the ethics of God. And this is at the heart of why God gave Israel a sacrificial system. It included offerings that were to be given of free will, but also some that were required because of this negative element of our existence known as sin. The term sin is used 583 times in the Bible. In the Hebrew, the expression sin is pronounced, and I may get this wrong, katayaya, also katayith, and it means an offense. It comes from a Hebrew term kata, which means to miss, as in missing the mark. It points to a standard of behavior that is expected of people, and when we stray from the behavior that God expects, it means that we miss our goal. The goal of consistent righteousness. And so all of us miss this mark at times. But this simply because it's a part of our human nature does not mean it's an excuse to sin. It's simply a fact of our humanity, but it's something that we can overcome. It is something we can deal with in a righteous manner. And so the sacrifices were necessary, and they portrayed ultimately the sacrifice of Jesus Christ that was required of him because of this human tendency to miss the mark of his righteousness. Jeremiah 7 and verse 22, God is speaking through the prophet here, and he says, "For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices, but this is what I commanded them," saying, and he's saying initially, "This is what I commanded them, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you. Yet they did not obey or incline their ear, but followed the counsels and dictates of their evil hearts and went backward and not forward." So God would have preferred that there would be no need for sacrifices. And this is indicated in Psalm 40 and verse 6 and also Hosea 6 and verse 6. But as far as we know, they weren't commanded until the Decalogue was declared at Sinai. But we do see that they were allowed in the beginning, perhaps even encouraged or inspired by God, I would say. And we saw in the book of Job that he actually required sacrifices to be made. And later they were instituted among a people called to be a nation, an entire nation. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people living under the law of God. It was something that they would be required to give because of anticipated continual sin. Let's go back now to Leviticus 4. As we begin to read the ordinances of the sin offering, we will see that they fell into four classes of people, and they were slightly different according to each class of people. Now, the opening statement here in verses 1 and 2 of Leviticus 4 introduces the reason that this offering would be required. It says in verse 1, "Now the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, saying, If a person sins unintentionally against any of the commandments of the Eternal in anything which ought not to be done, and does any of them," and there's a bit of a pause here, I have a comma, and because I'm going to stop there for a moment, even though there's no period, because then the next verse goes into the first class of people or individuals that would need to make this kind of offering. But the first thing we notice when it gives us these introductory words here is that this is an offering for sin, but unintentional sins, sins that the people were unaware of, but still considered sin because simply because they didn't know it was a sin doesn't mean that it's not a sin. It's a sin of ignorance or a mistake, some people might call it. And this is different than a trespass offering. And we're not going to talk about the trespass offerings this evening, but the trespass offering was one where the sin was known, but, you know, perhaps maybe it wasn't fully considered or understood, but it was something that was known by the individual. They should have known better, and they did it anyway. And we'll discuss that later, and that requires a different type of offering. But for some people, it may be difficult to distinguish between the two of intentional and unintentional sin. I hope we understand it. It's not too hard. The sin offering are ones that were given for sins that were realized at a later time. And it could have been minutes later, hours later, days later, maybe months or possibly years later. Maybe they realized, oh, I shouldn't have done that. But it was still, they would still require a sin offering. People sin frequently. And many times, we sin unknowingly, so we're very familiar with that concept. And while the sin offering is made for the person as a sinner, the trespass offerings that we will talk about in another study are made for particular sins, certain acts that need to be reconciled. Now, this doesn't mean that similar acts are not to be considered when presenting a sin offering. It could be that one of the sins that are indicated in the trespass offering are ones that was unintentional. So the details for the offering will differ in both of the offenses. But I want to continue now after the introduction here where God dictates what should be done when the high priest sins unintentionally. And we're going to read verses 3 through 12. "If the anointed priest sins, bringing guilt on the people, then let him offer to the Eternal for his sin, which he has sinned, a young bull without blemish as a sin offering. He shall bring the bull to the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Eternal, lay his hand on the bull's head, and kill the bull before the Eternal. Then the anointed priest shall take some of the bull's blood and bring it to the tabernacle of meeting. The priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle some of the blood seven times before the Eternal in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of sweet incense before the Eternal, which is in the tabernacle of meeting, and he shall pour the remaining blood of the bull at the base of the altar of the burnt offering, which is outside of the tent of meeting, outside the door of the tabernacle of meeting, as it says. He shall take from it all of the fat, talking of the offering, from it all of the fat of the bull as the sin offering, the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat which is on the entrails, the two kidneys and the fat that is on them by the flanks, and the fatty lobe attached to the liver above the kidneys, he shall remove, as it was taken from the bull of the sacrifice of the peace offering, so in a similar manner. And the priest shall burn them on the altar of the burnt offering. But the bull's hide and all its flesh, which is going to be the majority of the animal here, with its head and legs, its entrails and offal, the whole bull he shall carry outside the camp to a clean place where the ashes are poured out, and burn it on wood with fire where the ashes are poured out. It shall be burned in this location. So each class of person was required a different procedure for handling the offering, and or a different animal, or both. The first class is the high priest here, and this is required of the priest who would have sinned unintentionally to lay hands on the animal to kill it. And the sin offering we see in this case, being a young bull, was larger than some of the ones we're going to read just a bit later. And therefore, because it was a larger animal, a bull, this would have been a bovine animal, that it would be of more monetary value. And this would mean a higher cost of paying for this unintentional sin. And of course, because of the value of the animal, something that would be worth a lot, that's worth a lot of money today. I mean, look at the price of beef, how much an entire cow or bull is worth, a lot of money. And this would have been the same in those times. And so this would cause the individual that might have to offer something to be very diligent about the sin. Make sure you don't sin, even if it's unintentional, because you're going to have to pay something for it. And also, I think there's something else to be understood in this because of this higher requirement of the offering, the sin offering, and it's this. It's that God is more critical of individuals that are in the ministry. They are held, if you will, to a higher standard. I mean, we all have the same commandments. We all should have the same standards. But when it comes to those that are in the ministry, as James said in chapter 3 and verse 1, he warned people. He said, "Let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment." And so he encourages people not to try to be teachers. I mean, today we see so many people, I should be in charge, and I'm going to start my own group, and people that are not even ordained, doing their own thing, having their own churches, their own organizations, accepting their own tithes and doing what they want on the holy days. But God warns people not to do this. You know, priests, pastors, elders, and those who teach, they serve as authoritative representatives of Christ, and therefore they are ordained, they are role models in this way to other individuals. And so they have a strict responsibility to know what God requires and to teach those requirements to others. And of course, to be very critical of themselves to make sure that they are always on track with what God requires of people and requires of them. But when people are not ordained, when they do not have that responsibility, but try to be a teacher, I think a lot of them are not as critical. And perhaps they take a little more liberty in their behavior. And God warns them, look, if you're going to put yourself in that position, you're going to receive a stricter judgment. You better be careful about it. And so it is that I think this is an indication in the bovine animal that was to be offered when the sin was realized. If you have a ribbon, go ahead and put it here in Leviticus chapter 4, and I'd like you to turn back to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 1. So the first step was for the priest to lay hands on the animal and to kill it. And this, as we had discussed in the past, in the burnt offering, this portrays transferring the sin to the animal, and the sin that would require the animal to die because of sin transferred to it. And understanding that Christ died once for all sins, we see again the similarities between Christ and this sin offering. And also the animal was to be what? without blemish, an animal without blemish, no spot or blemish of any sort. It could not be lame, it could not have a disease, it couldn't have a scar on it, some kind of birth defect, none of that. It had to be an animal that, as far as the individual could tell, this animal was a perfect example of what a young bull should be like. Because if there was any spot or blemish, it would be unacceptable to be offered to God. It would be rejected. And of course, this is a reflection of Christ, the perfect man, the perfect individual of God. 1 Peter 1 and verse 18 says, knowing that you were not redeemed with, verse 18, knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as a lamb without blemish and without spot. And so we see that reflection in the sin offering as it was in the burnt offerings. Paul had also said in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 21 that Christ knew no sin. Now, Christ obviously knew what sin was, but he did not know it. It was not something that was intimate with him. He felt the pulls of sin, just like you and I feel the pulls of sin each day. But he learned from a very young age not to give in to the desires of sin. He grew in grace and knowledge as a child. And had there been a desire in the heart of Christ to commit a sinful act, had he committed an act of sin, had he acted upon thoughts of imperfection, he would not have been able to become a curse for others. He would have himself needed to have a sin offering offered on his behalf. But he was tested by God, he was tested by devils, he was tested by men, and the trials only proved him to be true and faithful, a true and faithful servant. Thus says the true and faithful servant, as he said in the book of Revelation, the only and holy Son of the living God. Isaiah 53 Christ suffered terribly, and everything that he suffered was not for anything wrong that he had done. He was entirely innocent. And so consider this similarity with the animal that was chosen to be offered. It was an animal without blemish. But these animals, too, are what? Sometimes they're referred to as innocent creatures, right? They're innocent. They have no conscience. They have no moral commandments, as you and I do. You know, we have a set of laws and rules that we are to live by. They don't have that. And so they're not guilty of committing any sin according to God. You know, Paul had said in Romans 3 and verse 20, by the law is the knowledge of sin. And he also said in chapter 5 and verse 13, sin is not imputed when there is no law. So does the animal kingdom have a set of 10 commandments? No, they do not. And so they don't break the commandments. They don't have the morals that you and I do. And so they behave according to instinct. And that's something that you and I don't have. We do not have instinct like the animals do. And so therefore, they are innocent. And I think this is something that's similar with Christ, that he was innocent. But he did have a set of moral laws like we do. But nonetheless, he was entirely innocent, without spot, without blemish. And even though he was innocent, he was required to die in order for this lesson to be learned by us of what sin requires. That Christ, it says here in verse 5 of Isaiah 53, he was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are therefore healed. Wonderful thing. Thank God for Christ. And so for this reason, the sin offering required the shedding of blood. It required the animal to die. Revelation 8, as we discuss the next part of this preparation here of the sin offering, it was a unique aspect of this offering found in the next up here. That is, after the draining of the blood, it was to be gathered up, and a portion of it was to be taken to the tabernacle of meeting, sprinkled there, and then taken into the tent of meeting. And this is into the place where the lampstand stood. This is the place where the table of showbread was, and the showbread was placed. This is the area that had the altar of incense. That was kind of a smaller version, if you will, of the altar where the burnt offerings were placed, but also made of a different material. But it had a similar thing where it had horns on the sides of it. So some of the blood was to be taken into this tent of meeting and to be sprinkled on the altar of incense, along with some incense for the burning. Now, this is very unusual. The burnt offerings only saw blood sprinkled on and around the sacrificial altar outside of the tent of meeting. So why use the altar of incense in this way? It's very interesting. You know, incense, we understand, represents something, doesn't it? What does it represent? It represents the prayers of the saints. And we have this example here in Revelation 8 and verse 3, when John had this vision of God's throne and things going on in God's throne room. It says, another angel having a golden censer came and stood at the altar, and he was given much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. And that portrays the golden altar of incense in the place of meeting. And it says, and goes further in verse 4, and the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hand. And we also have the example in Psalm 141. You don't have to turn there. I'm just going to read it. I have it in my notes, Psalm 141 and verse 2, where it says, let my prayer be set before you as incense, the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. And so this representation of the altar of incense was understood for a long, long time. So we have the sprinkling of the blood from the sin offering on the altar of incense within the holy place, and it portrays the prayers of the saints being affected by the blood of Christ. And so with this in mind, how much then should we consider the blood of Christ when we are offering up our prayers to God? I think we should do it more often than we do. Because the animal was without spot or blemish, the next part of the procedure says that select portions called fat, along with the kidneys, along with the gallbladder, other portions of fat I'm not entirely familiar with, but these were placed on the brass altar in the courtyard. This is the burnt offering altar in the courtyard. And this is also unlike offerings burned on the sacrificial altar, where the majority was put on the brass altar and burned there, and they were considered to be a sweet aroma to God. Now, it's not initially called, this sin offering is not called the sweet aroma to him, at least in this place here. We see it is referred to a sweet aroma in another place in this chapter. But because it's not initially called a sweet aroma, it could be an indication that the sin offering was not necessarily pleasing to God. However, I do find it difficult to believe that God would not be pleased with the repentance of an individual and a desire of people to attempt to make our wrong right, to reconcile with him. I think anytime sin is recognized by us and we repent of that and we change our behavior, I think God desires to see that kind of attitude in each of us. Hebrews 13, go ahead and, we were in Revelation, huh? Yeah, okay. Hebrews 13. We also see in the instructions that we had read so far in Leviticus 4 that most of the animal, all of the muscle, the hide, the head, the legs, that these were taken outside of the tabernacle, outside of the court, taken outside of the camp to a place where the ashes were dumped. And the offering was entirely burned in this place outside of the congregation, of course, burned upon what, when it comes to a young bull, it would have had to have been a fair amount of wood. What was the purpose for this? Why did God require this to be done? Because this is also unusual when it comes to a comparison to all of the other offerings. Well, Paul gave us part of the reason when mentioning this ceremony in Hebrews 13, and we're going to read verses 11 and 12, where he said, "For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate." And so again, we see this representation of Christ in the sin offering, taking outside of the temple, outside of the city gate, and crucified in a place called Golgotha, which today that same area is called Skull Hill. And the separation, taking outside, away from the tent of meeting, away from the tabernacle itself, outside of the city, I think this separation was further felt by Christ as he was nailed to the stake in agony, his life literally draining out of him, and he felt that necessary distance that had to come between him and that which is holy, his Father. And he cried out at that time, "What? My God, why have you forsaken me?" And so the Father turned away from him at this time, but only temporarily, so that the sin offering could be fulfilled in this way. Let's go back to Leviticus 4 now. Leviticus 4. There are further instructions for the sin offering when it comes to a sin offering that would be required of other individuals. Now, verses 13 through 21 are for groups of people, and it refers to them simply as, or collectively as, the congregation. And it could be that it could be when it comes to the entire nation, the whole congregation of Israel, or maybe an entire tribe, or maybe all of the elders, or all of the priests. But in any case, congregation is used in a lot of different contexts, but it just means a group of people who might, and in this case, might sin unintentionally. So Leviticus 4 and verse 13, we're going to read 13 through 21. "Now, if the whole congregation of Israel sins unintentionally, and the thing is hidden from the eyes of the assembly, and they have done something against any of the commandments of the Eternal in anything which should not be done, and are guilty, when the sin which they have committed becomes known, then the assembly shall offer a young bull," same type of animal as the one previously for the high priest, "a young bull for the sin, and bring it before the tabernacle of meeting. And the elders of the congregation shall lay their hands on the head of the bull before the Eternal," again, picturing a transference of sin to the animal, "then the bull shall be killed before the Eternal. And the anointed priest shall bring some of the bull's blood to the tabernacle of meeting. And then the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle it seven times before the Eternal in front of the veil. And he shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar which is before the Eternal, which is in the tabernacle of meeting. And he shall pour out the remaining blood at the base of the altar of the burnt offering, which is at the door of the tabernacle of meeting." So again, the same thing that was done before, where a portion will be brought inside of the tent of meeting and put on the altar of incense. "And he shall take all the fat from it and burn it on the altar. And he shall do with the bull as he did with the bull of his sin offering. Thus he shall do with it." So it's me treating it the same way you did in the previous procedure that was discussed. "And so the priest shall make atonement for them, and it shall be forgiven them. And then he shall carry the bull outside the camp and burn it as he burned the first bull. It is a sin offering for the assembly. And so we see that there is a similar procedure. It's pretty much exactly the same way it was done before, with the exception that more people would lay hands on the bull, portraying a transference of the sin of the whole congregation onto the animal. And now the next verses 22 through 26, tell what was to be done when a civil leader had sinned unintentionally. When a ruler has sinned and done something unintentionally against any of the commandments of the Eternal, his God, and anything which should not be done, and is guilty, or if his sin which he has committed comes to his knowledge, he shall bring as his offering a kid of the goats, a male without blemish, and he shall lay his hand on the head of the goat and kill it at the place where they kill the burnt offering before the Eternal. It is a sin offering, so there's a different animal now to be used. The same transference of sin to the animal. And the priest shall take some of the blood of the sin offering with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of the burnt offering and pour its blood at the base of the altar of the burnt offering. And so you don't bring it into the tent of meeting in this case. And he shall burn all its fat on the altar like the fat of the sacrifice of the peace offering. And so the priest shall make atonement for him concerning his sin, and it shall be forgiven him. So again, it's taking the fat of this animal, putting it on the brazen altar there, but it doesn't say take the rest of the animal and burn it outside the camp, like was what was to be done in the previous offerings. And so in verse 27, it talks about what was to be done if a common person, not one of the leaders, but a common person, had sinned unintentionally. If any one of the common people sins unintentionally by doing something against any of the commandments of the Eternal and anything which is ought not to be done and is guilty, or if his sin which he has commanded comes to his knowledge, then he shall bring as his offering a kid of the goats, same as the one previously, a female this time, without blemish, for his sin which he has committed. And he shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and kill the sin offering at the place of the burnt offering. Then the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of the burnt offering. Again, this is the one outside and not inside the tent of meeting, and pour all the remaining blood at the base of the altar. He shall remove all its fat, as fat is removed from the sacrifice of the peace offering. So a similar way that was done when regarding the peace offering that we had already discussed in a previous study. And the priest shall burn it on the altar for a sweet aroma to the Eternal. Again, so here is an example where the sin offering is considered a sweet aroma to the Eternal. And the priest shall make atonement for him, and it shall be forgiven him. But if he brings a lamb as his sin offering, he shall bring a female without blemish. So God allows for one or two of the two animals here. Then he shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and kill it as a sin offering at the place where they kill the burnt offering. And the priest shall take some of the blood of the sin offering with his finger, put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering, and pour all the remaining blood at the base of the altar. He shall remove all its fat, as the fat of the lamb is removed from the sacrifice of the peace offering. And then the priest shall burn it on the altar according to the offerings made by fire to the Eternal. And so the priest shall make atonement for his sin that he has committed, and it shall be forgiven him. And so we notice that there are different procedures here for these last two classes of people. And this peculiarity is not found in any of the other offerings, a difference between these different classes of people. And these are differences that are definitely worth our attention. I mean, everything God does is worth our attention. But I'm not afraid to admit, I don't have all the answers for all of the representation and the different ways they are handled. I have some of the answers. Now, we had already seen how Christ was represented in a young bull, being a young man, very strong in mind and in body, hardworking, even though he was relatively young. He's also portrayed by a goat. And we saw that example. We talked about that before, about how he was very strong-willed in his resolve, going against the grain. Sometimes when the grain was going against the ways of God, he was not afraid of being a leader, like many times goats are. Sometimes we've heard that expression before, stubborn as a goat. but in this case, in a positive way, when it comes to being stubborn against the ways of the world. And so he had a lot of resolve. So there are other reasons for the variations, and I've read a few commentaries about these before I went through these studies to see if a few individuals that I respect their opinion have further insight into the subject. One of them I read was a book by Andrew Jukes that was called The Law of the Offerings, and this man does have some insight into the offerings and their representation. But Jukes, as I began to read his book, which I read the beginning of some time ago, I noticed that in the beginning he made reference to giving some of his understanding, giving some credit to another individual. He didn't name the individual, though. He just said it simply came from some writings called Types in Leviticus. Now, I looked it up, and I was able to track down a single copy. And anywhere in the internet in the world, I was only able to track down a single copy of this book that Andrew Jukes referred to. And I read it, and it seems to be written by an individual. There's no author in the beginning of it. I have it right here. In the very back of it, it gives a reference to where it says, addresses of others who would like these papers and correspondence may be concerned for the unity of the faith are welcomed. H.G. Hobbs in Sudbury, Suffolk. So I don't know who that individual is, but as I was reading through, it's a very small book. It'd be considered a booklet according to the literature that we publish. But it seemed to me that for the most part, this individual had some Protestant and in some ways some Catholic beliefs to some of those things that he referred to. But I did find one page very interesting. He too did not understand all of the representation in some of in the offerings and why they were used and why certain things were done with them. But he did have some understanding, and I think this leans to something. You know, the Bible can give anyone who desires to read it and seeks knowledge and desires not to their own understanding. It can give anyone knowledge. And I found something interesting, and he wrote, when he was talking about the differences in these sin offerings for the different classes of people, he said this, and I'm going to read this one page here, page 34 in this book. It says, Israel had both rulers and a land and an earthly calling, and they will have the same in the future, talking about the second Exodus. Therefore, we see in the offerings for these two classes a foreshadowing of the time when Israel will be restored to their land and they will obtain forgiveness on the same basis as we. But Israel will never have the like calling with ourselves. In the millennium, they will have an earthly temple where God will make his presence manifest. And it refers to Ezekiel 43. And there will be no reproach to bear for the name of Christ when he is reigning on the earth. Thus we see the further application of the atoning blood of Christ beyond the church to the nation of God's choice. But we can carry the view still further and see the effect of the reproach of Christ even in the new heavens and new earth. We know that the marriage of the Lamb takes place when he comes for his bride before the millennium, but during the millennium, not only Israel will be saved, but Gentiles too. But as the marriage of the Lamb will already have taken place, it is obvious they cannot be included in the bride. The saved ones of past dispensations will be included in the bride, being raised with us when the eternal comes, or when the Lord comes, perfected as to their spirits, but waiting the resurrection with us. This is Church of God, understand. Those who died in the faith in the past dispensations bore reproach and persecution even among Israel. And that is even called in Hebrews 11:26, the reproach of Christ. And so we see how closely are the saints identified with us. The glorious prospect presented to us in 2 Timothy 2:12 is that if we suffer with Christ, we shall also reign with him. And this is not limited to the millennial reign, for 2 Corinthians 4 tells us that it is an eternal weight of glory. Thus our minds are led on to the eternal state in the new heavens and new earth. And Revelation 21 and 22 identify the new Jerusalem with the church and that city is called the bride, as well as the people. In Galatians 4 says, Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all, and that includes Old and New Testament saints alike. The city is the house too, which our Lord has gone to prepare. And being the Father's house, there is no need of a temple in it, but the bride will dwell there, and therefore our priestly privilege of drawing near to the throne then will exceed immeasurably that of present time. Now it is in the spirit, then it will be in a bodily presence, a glorified body. But this is reserved for those who calling it has been to bear the reproach of Christ. Those saved in the millennium will have no reproach, and thus, as we have seen, will not be included in the bride. They are seen to occupy the earth, and they bring their glory and honor into the city, but they have not the position of nearness that belongs to the bride. So I think that's quite insightful. This individual did have some insight because of his fervent study of the scriptures. And so we see then that the Bible has a lot to offer people, even people that are not called. If they desire to understand what God desires of us, God is going to give them something. They might not be called for the first resurrection, but he is going to certainly not withhold certain knowledge from people. Well, not revealing everything, but he will give people that want to know him an understanding of what he is doing and what he requires of people at this day in this day and age. Now, there's one last difference between these offerings that I'm going to mention and how the animal was treated after being sacrificed. And this is noted in Leviticus 6. Leviticus 6 in verse 24, where it goes back and it gives some further information about the offerings in chapters 6 and 7. But we're going to just read verses 24 through 30 of chapter 6, where it says, Also the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, This is the law of the sin offering. In the place where the burnt offering is killed, the sin offering shall be killed before the Eternal. It is most holy. The priest who offers it for sin shall eat it. In a holy place it shall be eaten, in the court of the tabernacle of meeting. Everyone who touches its flesh must be holy. And when its blood is sprinkled on any garment, you shall wash that on which it was sprinkled in a holy place. But the earthen vessel in which it is boiled shall be broken, and if it is boiled in a bronze pot, it shall be both scoured and rinsed in water. All the males among the priests may eat it. It is most holy. And so it's talking about the last two sin offerings we discussed, because it says in verse 30, But no sin offering from which any of the blood is brought into the tabernacle of meeting to make atonement in the holy place shall be eaten. It shall be burned in the fire. Let's go over to Acts 3, and we're going to end over there. Acts chapter 3. All of these sin offerings that we have discussed this evening are for sins of ignorance. And this could include more than simply not knowing. It's making a mistake. You know, ignorance lessens the severity of the sin or the offense, but it doesn't make the person innocent of sin. You know, whether we understand what the law is or not doesn't mean the law is void if we don't know it. Some people don't want to know, and they think they can be good without knowing what the law is. But the law is still the law regardless, because we're human and we're subject to the law of God. And even Peter told those people who were in part responsible for crucifying Christ, people who cried out and said, Crucify him! They wanted Christ to die. Many of these people did not understand. And he said this in Acts 3 and verse 17. Next page. He said, Yet now, brethren, I know that you did it in ignorance, as did also your rulers. But those things which God foretold by the mouth of all his prophets, that the Christ would suffer, as he has thus fulfilled, Repent, therefore, and be converted, that your sins may be blotted out, so that the times of refreshing may come from the presence of the Lord. So even when sin is unintentional, done in ignorance, when it's realized there needs to be repentance, there needs to be a change of behavior. And the offerings found in the burnt offering, the grain offering, the peace offerings, these were offerings for acceptance by God. But the sin offering, as well as the trespass offering that we will discuss next time, are for expiation. Those sacrifices, all of them, were given as a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ so that we might know Him and know what sin requires. The sin offering that Christ made on Golgotha is enough to purge every single sin of every human being. But this does not allow for us to take sin lightly, because I think that's what many people, many religious people that call themselves Christian do. They discount sin because they don't have to sacrifice a bull or a goat or a lamb. But we should never, ever take this lightly. We must, by necessity and as a sign of our appreciation to God, strive to not sin. As the Apostle John said, "These things I write to you, that you do not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous." However, he says, whoever abides in him does not sin intentionally. They do not continue to practice sin intentionally. Whoever treats sin lightly, Paul said, without concern, John said, has neither seen him or known him. And that's the kind of faith that you and I are required to strive to have, to expiate sin, to allow for us to have Christ's sacrifice applied to us in order to be reconciled to God, in order to be able to enter the kingdom of heaven. And so whenever sin is discovered in our lives, whether it's unintentional or not, we need to offer sincere repentance in the name of Christ and through Christ as our Savior. Repent of sin and learn from the schoolmaster the lesson of the sin offering. So we're going to go ahead and wrap it up now, and we're going to pause for a few minutes while we shut everything down here, and then we'll go ahead and dial into the other phone number where we will take some questions and answers, have a little discussion about the Bible study this evening. For those people who might want to join in that discussion, you have some Church of God experience or understanding, you can contact us and we'll try to get with you and get that information out to you to join us at a later time. Thank you for joining, and have a good evening.